This is an ABC podcast.
Farmers in flood-affected parts of New South Wales and Queensland grapple with the aftermath of the catastrophe, including the orphan rubbish left behind by floodwaters.
It's not only this sort of irrigation pipe. We've got logs, we've got fuel tanks, most anything that would float out of the backyard of somewhere, we're going to find it in our blocks of cane. Yeah.
And
the 2022 NBA Draft, the New Orleans Pelicans select Dyson. Yeah!
Bendigo local Dyson Daniels becomes the latest Australian basketballer to join the NBA. I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country. It's been a disastrous start for almost every primary industry operating in the flood-affected Northern Rivers region in New South Wales. From beef to beekeeping, soybeans to sugarcane, industries have been shattered. The latest report card has put a $500 million figure on the financial costs of these floods to local agriculture in physical damage and asset losses. For those in the land, it's not just the two major floods, but 3 months of almost continuous rain that slowed harvest and recovery efforts. Bronwyn Herbert has this story.
Lismore dairy farmer Lee Sherman guides her girls through their morning milking ritual.
Come on, it's all right. They won't bite. Come on.
A few months ago, North Coast dairy farmers were confronting a crisis they had never before witnessed. Floodwaters washing valuable stock out to sea, homes inundated and machinery gone. But for this third generation dairy farmer, things haven't improved.
Even though the flood was the 28th of February, things have not improved. If anything, on dairy farms, things have got worse because of the continued wet weather. There's no fences left out there. It's only the perimeters. But that's where all my young stock were, and it's just so wet. It was too deep. Yeah. So they weren't happy. And that's... Yeah.
It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And then the continual rain ever since has really taken a toll on their health. And that's hard to watch. And I do worry. I do worry what the northern dairy industry is going to look like by the end of winter.
The season's been one to forget for the soybean industry too. Ross Larson operates Mara Global Foods, a food and stock feed manufacturing plant based near Casino.
I think in the Northern Rivers here, we've probably lost between $30 and $35 million of crops. And from a value-added perspective with manufacturing, probably an additional 20 on top of that.
Lost. Big numbers, isn't it?
Oh, it is big numbers if you put it into perspective how that flows out into the economy. When you start to see commerce start to grind to a halt, you know, that affects everyone who owns a takeaway shop through to, you know, bigger companies like this. I get concerned, you know, we really have to think about our staff and their welfare and their mental side of things. But it's every shop that you walk into in Casino, it's every shop you walk into that's left in Lismore. Everybody's affected, you can see it. It's like there's a hangover from the floods that just can't be lifted at the moment.
That hangover is causing more than a headache.
With all of the follow-up rain that we've received, we're definitely going to get at least 80 to 90% of the farmers will not be able to get a winter crop in. They physically cannot get on the country. You'd need a hovercraft to be able to farm a lot of it.
On the coastal floodplain near Woodburn, widespread destruction is clearly on show with fields of once green sugarcane, now brown stalks. Chairman of the Woodburn Cane Harvesting Cooperative, Jeff Gollan, is still deliberating how harvesters will salvage what's left.
There's a lot of acreage being just killed. Us personally, I think we've lost about 220 acres of year-old crop. Yeah, we don't know what the future holds.
Adding to the woes, so-called orphan rubbish is littered throughout the fields.
Well, this is a major problem that we're going to have throughout the harvest season, for the next two seasons actually, is what they call an orphan rubbish. It's not only this sort of irrigation pipe, we've got logs, we've got fuel tanks, most anything that would float out of the backyard of somewhere, we're going to find it in our blocks of cane. Yeah.
The 65-year-old is slowly coming to terms with not just the scale of losses in the paddock, but his community.
The cane harvesting community in our local area, they've all lost homes bar three. I think we've got 27 members. Their main objective at the moment is to get a house for their family to live in, and the farming side of it is really going to come secondary until they've got somewhere to put their family.
Down the road at East Corakai, cane farmer Jeff Pye is facing a long wait for repairs before he can move back into his family home. He's trying to find some humour in finding a neighbour's in-ground swimming pool in his cane field.
Yeah, it's a bit of an eye-opener, isn't it? So the thing floated along until it finally filled up with water and just sat down in the cane, but it looks like it's in good nick, so hopefully we'll be able to return it to its owner.
The macadamia industry is hurting too. More than 270,000 trees have been planted on the Richmond River floodplain over the past 5 years. Mel and Ron Casaniga planted 10,000 trees at Dungaruba to help scale up their existing orchard near Lismore.
We started farming with the design that we are on a floodplain, and we put checks and balances in place to work with that. But then it rained and rained and rained, and the second flood came in, and we had water over the block again for another 10 days. That one flood wasn't as big. It was below the 54 level by 20 centimetres, but the water just really hung around. All the tributaries back down to the ocean, I guess, were still pretty blocked up from the first flood. The water just wasn't moving.
The macadamia industry estimates at least $30 million in losses, including 150,000 young trees, now skeletons in the floodplain. It's not enough to deter the Casanigas, who are readying to step back in behind the planter and do it all again.
Now we're seeing it as a challenge to get it back there again. Yeah, we're getting trees organised now. Tomorrow we start doing a bit of tidying up here. We won't plant till spring, but we can certainly get the soil in really great shape between now and spring, ready for that spring planting.
Such stoic people, Mel Casaniga, ending that story from Bronwyn Herbert. And you can see the full story on Landline this Sunday at 12:30. Art is meant to inspire you, move you, and get you thinking about the world. Australian artist William Dobell's painting Storm Approaching Wanji moved James Drinkwater so much he painted his own version and created a ballet. He's a Newcastle-based abstract artist turned ballet dancer. So how does an artwork inspire a ballet? Our reporter, Newcastle's Dan Cox, needed to know more, so he visited James Drinkwater in his studio.
I'm in a studio surrounded by massive canvases, loads of colourful paint, thick textures, and I can see spray paint and paint brushes and a massive palette over there with loads of paint sitting on top of it. I'm in James Drinkwater's studio. He is an abstract artist, which is how people know you, James, but I hear you're also a ballet dancer.
Arguably. You know those things you're remiss about as you enter adulthood, like, I wish I could play the piano. I wish I could get on that thing and make it sing. For me, it's been ballet, and I do come to it very green and as a novice. However, in 2014, I want to say, I did enrol in night classes for ballet, classical ballet.
You didn't just keep dreaming about it. You actually did something about it. Over the last 8-9 years, what have you learned? Are you good at it?
Well, no, I'm not. And it lasted about a year. It really was for the paintings, really. I had an exhibition coming up in Sydney at the time, just had a son, and the exhibition was called The Boy and the Ballet. So the ballet became a metaphor for life and extravagance and the hardship. Also, I think I grew up drawing the figure, drawing the nude, and I wanted that discipline. I wanted something linear. Dancing is drawing. It's about line. But I didn't want to go back. You know, I'm not good at repeating. It just gets stale for me, so I always want to be in the sandpit. So I enrolled and really enjoyed it. It was very humbling. And I think someone once said that me pirouetting is like a wombat falling down a cliff.
You take that as a compliment?
I may have said it myself. Yeah, no, it's fine. I'm okay with not being good at it because it wasn't about that. It was I wanted to get inside the language and see it from the interior.
Did dance change your paintings? Does one inspire the other?
Absolutely.
How?
It made me open my chest, stand up proudly, forgive myself, and walk with grace into that series of paintings.
Let's talk about William Dobell for a moment. Storm Approaching Wanji. When you saw that painting, what did you think the first time? How did it affect you?
I remember just thinking, what a beautiful person. Someone beautiful painted this. Someone who's been through a lot. It's hard to express. In fact, words almost sort of devalue it. I know we have to find words. We're in an interview. However, it's such a moving painting. It's such a small little thing, full of humility, desires, anguish, unresolved things going on. But then all at once, it's just a storm approaching Wanji. And, you know, I remember my grandmother saying, let's all get on the veranda, the subtlety's coming. There's kind of a celebratory thing going on as well. The casuarinas are leaning and contorting like dancers. You can just see Bill's white, gorgeous little home being thrashed by the storm. There's something thrilling about a subtlety. But also, you know, for a generation of men and women that often had to suppress things, I think this little painting is so, so loaded.
To the point where it inspires a ballet that you've created, yeah. Storm Approaching Wanji and Other Desires. Tell me about the ballet.
I visited Dobell House when I got back from Germany years ago, and then some years later, I read Scott Bevan's Dobell book, simply titled Bill. I made the pilgrimage out to Wanji to look at the house. No one was there. The museum wasn't open that day, but I definitely jumped the fence and, you know, touched the garden and tried to soak up some of the spirit, like you would in Europe to visit Vincent and Theo. It was a similar pilgrimage, you know, no greater, no less. And a very beautiful day. My kids said, what are we doing here? I'm like, just cop it, you know. We're seeing William. And I made a painting from that experience of his house.
So it started with the painting before the ballet. What is your version of Storm Approaching Wanji and Other Desires as a painting look like?
It glows. It's this white, if I can say so myself. There's this sort of white hovering house shrouded by shrubbery and plants of that generation, things my grandmother would have grown, you know, hydrangeas and agapanthus and succulents. And it really is an inquiry, I think, the painting. It really is, you know, what is going on in there? Why can't I get in?
And then you go and create a ballet. What does that look like? Have you choreographed before?
No. And I'm not choreographing. It's a collaborative work. The choreographers are Belle Beasley and Skip Wilcox, and they're very accomplished at choreography. So I'm in safe hands. The composer is Joe Franklin from Melbourne. It's interesting as you, I suppose, if you want to call this mid-career or whatever, like approaching 40, storm approaching 40. You turn around and all your friends you came up with are sort of grown-ups with real jobs and accomplishments, and you're collaborating with friends but professionals. It's so exciting to work with these people.
So you get to work with some of these friends. You're collaborating with your choreographers and your composer. How have you made the ballet reflect Dobell's painting?
I wrote a loose narrative. It's four parts. Dobell in Newcastle, a sooty town, body surfing at Bar Beach, Cook's Hill, you know, working class, Sydney, France, comes back the Archibald success and controversy, then to Wanji to find respite and peace. There's still demons there. And then the final scene, which is, I read not in Bevan's book, but in another book, the night of Dobell's death. He was so hungry. He cooked two T-bones. He poured a big scotch. I think he had a cigarette and he just dropped dead in his kitchen. And I read that somewhere and I thought, oh, I better make sure that. And in the end, it does and doesn't matter, because it's now I'm taking his life and celebrating, but also abstracting it. And it's not a biography. That's been done superbly by other people. It's a tribute. It's a homage. There'll be storms. There'll be seagulls attacking the young boy, court scenes. It'll be very abstract.
That's Newcastle-based abstract artist James Drinkwater, and the music you heard is part of the ballet composed by Melbourne's Joseph Franklin. Now to Tassie. The Goss family have been at the heart of the Don River Railway line for three generations. In his 80s, Des Goss still hand-paints locomotives and works the steam trains with his son Grant and grandson Matt. Our reporter in Burnie, Rick Eves, sat on a plush first-class seat in a carriage at the station yard to chat with the filthy, sooty-faced Goss boys.
Hi, I'm Des Goss.
I'm Grant Goss.
And Matt Goss.
Three generations.
Yes, from 1973. I brought Grant with me as a young lad and got involved. I mean, we could not go away from the place. We decided just to have a look and we stayed.
Is that where your interest in trains began, though, or had you always had that?
My father worked on steam traction engines in the early days. I think it was in my blood.
Straight to the hospital if you've got steam in your blood.
Well, this is true, yes.
How old were you then and how old are you now?
My goodness, 80, over 80 at the moment.
Almost got a specific and he decided to go general.
Yes, I'm over 80 at the moment and climbing, of course. But yeah, I started back in I can't remember now what.
I'm 55. I must have been about six when I come down.
It was in Des's blood and you just had no choice at all.
Yeah, that's it, drummed into me. Yeah, no choice at all.
How it really started, I was into the Don Railway a bit, or Van Diemen Light Railway, them days, and I bought a train set for Grant for Christmas, and because I played with it more than he did.
What are your earliest memories, Grant, at age six?
I remember sort of the first day we come down here, there was a whiskery man that looks like someone that was on TV. His name was Glenn Stewart.
He looked like he was from the past.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always thought he looked strange. Yeah, we'll have a giggle at that. So they were ready to go down and start doing some track work. He said, oh, yeah, I'll hop on board. And my mum and my nan and my sisters were down at the beach and we forgot all about everyone at the beach at East Devonport. So they had to start walking home. So I remember that as well. But...
And Matt, what about you? You were born and these two were already way gone into train.
Yeah, that's right. Never really a choice. I had the steam bug as early as I can remember, so just steamrolled to where I am today, which is, yeah, a fully qualified driver. So,
is it literally the case that the earliest smells you can remember are like grease and oil and coal?
Yeah, definitely. And that's a big part of the attraction of a steam engine is the smells and the sounds. Down here now in a full-time capacity to do all the events and functions that we've now sort of grown into.
Are you all qualified drivers?
Yeah, I'm a qualified driver, a fireman, whatever. Yeah, diesel and steam.
Yeah, I'm a qualified fireman on the steam engine. I can drive all the diesels.
Des, though you don't even paint those toy trains that you stole off your son.
No.
You do paint the real ones here, by hand.
Yes, really like painting them.
How long does it take to paint a steam train?
Well, it depends how bad it is when it comes into the workshop. I start sandpapering and grinding it down, undercoat, three top coats.
Sounds like a life's work.
It's actually a pleasure to see the end article. I've been painting for the last 30 years.
I reckon you've painted probably everything here once or not twice.
Still got a few more years of painting left in me yet.
Yeah, because you're apparently 80-ish and
yeah.
The only thing you're honest about is it's still going up.
Yeah, this is true. Unfortunately, it is going up, but I think I've got another 10 years here yet.
So what, you'll be 95 when you finish?
Yeah, something like that. Keeps me going. Yeah.
Have you heard of spray painting technology?
Couldn't act of spray painting at all. I've got a good wrist and I've got a good eye.
How do the rest of the Goss family cope with you three stinking of grease, sooty faces all the time?
Well, my wife, she makes me do all the washing because she wouldn't want to touch them, I don't think.
It's called penance.
That's right, this is true. It was my job for 20 years, 12 and 13 hours a day, so I had to go home occasionally.
What about you, Matt? Are you already on to the fourth generation project?
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of pressure at home about that fourth generation. I think in the coming years, I'll be able to bring down, hopefully, a young son and show him the ropes.
But he will be a son. It won't be a daughter. You're an old world bunch, you trained people.
Yeah, no, daughter or son.
What are all the smells that make that train smell?
It's mainly the ash, the dripping of the oil, and coated on the outside as well. You just sort of can't get away from it.
Smells like history and adventure.
It does, yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah.
I had a ride in the loco with you. That's not so comfortable, is it?
It's a very different experience up front.
It's kind of raw.
It's something that, yeah, not many people get to experience. We feel very privileged.
Bernie reporter Rick Eaves having a good old time there with the Goss family on the Don River Railway.
This week on Landline, we unpack the numbers for pricey produce.
So where we were paying $60 for a bag of MKP, for example, we're now paying $120+.
And how do the farmers of New South Wales's northern rivers come back from catastrophe?
The cane harvesting community in our local area, they've all lost homes bar three. I think we've got 27 members.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
And right now you're with me, Sinead Mangan, on Australia Wide. Dyson Daniels from Bendigo in central Victoria has become the latest Australian basketballer to join the NBA. The New Orleans Pelicans picked him at number 8 in the draft, saying his strong defensive abilities and quick thinking will be an asset. The Victorian teenager is the 23rd Australian to go on to play in the NBA, but he's also the third Bendigo Braves player to make it to the most elite level. Ben McCauley is his former coach and the current coach of the Bendigo Braves Junior. He spoke with our reporter Shannon Schubert about Dyson's rise through the ranks.
In the 2022 NBA Draft, the New Orleans Pelicans select Dyson.
Yeah! What's good, Pels fans? Dyson Daniels here. Super excited to be drafted by New Orleans. You know, can't wait to get down there, meet the fans, meet the guys, meet the staff. You know, I can't wait to contribute, and you know, let's go deeper in the playoffs next year. Go Pelicans.
Dyson was fantastic to coach, fantastic athlete, always prepared to work hard, always prepared to listen and take on feedback and just get better. So can't praise him enough. He's a fantastic kid.
Was he always a special player too?
Yeah, he could always play. You could see there was something special about Dyson, and that was at both ends of the court, whether it was defensively or offensively. So he was always going to do something with his basketball career. And I've watched him and progress from Bendigo to the Institute of Sport or through the Global Academy, then to the when he made his debut for the Boomers to playing G League, and he just kept taking the next step and getting better and better. You can't talk highly enough about what the Global Academy did for his game and how he developed and see where he is today. So that's awesome.
And can you talk to us about the pathways and the milestones and how he got to where he is now?
His family's basketball renowned, so his dad's Ricky Daniels, who came to Bendigo in 99 and won several MVP of the leagues for the NBL 1 equivalent back then. So he had a pretty good teacher in his dad to start with. And from the moment he was around a basketball court, you could see he had skills and he was going to go somewhere. So from his coaching at home with his dad to junior Braves from 12 through to 18, and then over to the Global Academy, he's just continued to grow in leaps and bounds.
It's pretty incredible, isn't it? I remember as a local reporter talking to people in the basketball world about Dyson 4 years ago, and everyone just was like, this kid is going somewhere special. This kid's going to make it. And just to see that come to fruition now, how does that feel for you?
Oh, it's good. I've been lucky enough to watch Dyson grow up. So Dyson's Dyson to me, and he's just a fantastic person and a phenomenal athlete. So it's really exciting for Dyson and his family to see him achieve his childhood dream of playing in the NBA. So it's really exciting for Bendigo Basketball to see a kid that's come through our Junior Braves program. And it shows there is a great pathway here in Bendigo for kids to succeed and make the elite level. So we've got an under-14 boys group that just won the junior, the country champs. So they're off to Australian Nationals. And that's the pathway Dyson took back in 2015, I think it was. So you never know what's coming through the next lot of players at the Nationals from Bendigo. So it's good for kids to be able to dream and see that dreams can come real. So that's awesome.
Absolutely. I'm sure we're already excited for his next visit to inspire some more young basketball lovers.
Oh, that'll be fantastic. And Dyson's great with kids. And to Dyson, his mates in Bendigo, he hasn't changed. He's still Dyson Daniels, he's a bit of a larrikin and he's a funny kid. But he's still in regular contact with all his mates back here, and his success hasn't changed him.
Pretty amazing stuff. Bendigo basketball coach Ben McCauley telling Shannon Schubert about his friend and former player Dyson Daniels, who was this morning picked by the New Orleans Pelicans at number 8 in the NBA draft. Incredible stuff. And that's Australia Wide for this week. Thanks to Alex Hyman, the producer of Australia Wide, for everything he does for the show this week and every week, and to the team of reporters all around the country. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.